Welcome to the Australian Men's Rights Association podcast for the 5th of June 2018. I'm Rob Brockway, and with me I have Russell and Alex.
In a secret location in Brisbane.
Super secret.
What's been happening this week, Robert?
Well, Bettina Arndt has been talking about a couple of issues that have been going on. A gentleman by the name of Rob Tiller was constructively dismissed from Relationships Australia, WA. That's currently in with a...
unreasonable dismissal claim?
Yes, exactly. Thank you. That's what I was trying to think of, yes.
Okay, so let's outline some of the things we'll discuss, and then maybe we'll come back to that.
Okay.
Because I don't know much about it. What else? Do you have anything else you wanted to bring up tonight?
Well, there's also another one Bettina's talking about that I can bring up a little bit later on. Russell, did you have a couple of items?
Yes. Well, last week we were talking about consent, but we didn't quite get around to the Me Too movement, so we might just visit that also this evening.
Good.
So let's start with Relationships Australia, shall we?
Okay, great. So, Rob Tiller was a counsellor at Relationships Australia, Western Australia. Now, Relationships Australia is a national brand, but each of the states are really a separate organisation, I understand. And he was working for Relationships Australia, WA. This actually happened a couple of years ago. He was, Bettina Arndt wrote an article in the, which I think was in the Australian, which I read at the time, and Rob read it as well. And he had posted it on his personal Facebook page, and he had circulated it among people in his profession, just privately, a group of people. And that happened a couple of years ago. And then recently it came to the attention of Relationships Australia WA that that had occurred. And what we've been told that what's happened is that Rob has been called in for a meeting and been advised that if he doesn't resign, he'll be fired.
So what's Relationships Australia's stand on DV? Is there a policy that you can't discuss it in any other terms but gendered?
Oh, Relationships Australia WA follows the Duluth model, which we've talked about previously, and we can always cover that a little bit. And they also talk about feminism, I believe, on their website and talk about a feminist perspective, I believe.
And I understand it varies from state to state, you know, their actual positions.
But he hasn't been dismissed. He's been given the option to resign.
Yeah, my understanding is that's called constructive dismissal in Australia. And that means you're put in a situation where even though you're technically resigning, you basically have no option. I think it covers a few things. It covers situations where people continue to work, but they're put under pressure at work, or a situation like this where someone said, if you don't resign, you'll be fired.
Do you have contact with this fella?
Yes, I've had a chat with Rob Tiller recently, actually. He's a lovely fellow.
What sort of mindset is he in at the moment? Feeling a bit victimised?
Well, I think from what I understand, he was really quite shocked, actually, at what happened.
Sure. And I think there are downsides to be to constructively resign. I'm sure you might lose some benefits. Possibly you might have to wait some weeks. I'm not sure.
You'd lose your health service,
But if you're after like unemployment benefits, have to wait a certain period of time. If you resigned rather than be fired.
But I can't believe that this guy was putting this stuff up on his personal pages. He wasn't representing Relationships Australia. So I can't believe they can do that, frankly. He's got a good case, right?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I would say it sounds pretty good to me.
Bettina Arndt's come to his aid.
Yeah, Bettina's brought this into the public arena and shining a spotlight on it.
I've seen a bit about Bettina. Why do I keep seeing Bettina's name this week? Has she been doing other things? Has she just brought out an article? I know she's connected with Mission Australia.
Yes, that's right. She's doing something else as well, exactly. So Mission Australia has launched a domestic violence campaign, and it is very gendered. And she has also started to shine a spotlight on that as well.
Okay, so when you say it's very gendered, you mean that all statistics represent male violence, the usual?
And when they've got scenarios that they're showing and so forth, and they're always talking about violent men and so forth, rather than recognising that a very high proportion, around half of all domestic and intimate partner violence, is reciprocal, and they're not portraying what the data is actually showing.
I think it was you were saying last week in our podcast last week that if you really want to tackle domestic violence, you look at violence itself. If you look at it gendered, you're only going to make the problem worse or not fix it at all.
Intergenerational violence is much more, I think, constructive way to look at it. It's the way it's propagated through society, through generations.
In fact, that's something that Erin Pitsey found with her research.
Well, in some of the weekend papers, there have been commentary about DV. The commenters, are quite supportive of men and critical of the feminist position. But one thing struck me is the letters that men wrote centered around, you know, the shame of reporting, you know, or the fear of being ridiculed for going to the police or making a claim like this. And not one of them actually seemed to understand that there was a primary aggressor rule in one or more states. I'm not sure. Perhaps, do you know, Rob, what states do have a primary aggressor rule?
Can I just ask what the primary aggressor rule is?
That's that the male, in any case, in a DV call to the police, should be arrested, even if he's the victim.
But is that standard policy?
Well, this idea comes originally from the Duluth model, I believe, which was developed in Duluth, Minnesota, and used widely around the US and in other countries, including in Australia. Sometimes we use it by name, sometimes we don't, and it has this concept of the primary aggressor. So that, to me, says that they knew that reciprocal intimate partner violence was what was really going on. So they invented a way of getting around it, and they talk about one person being essentially worse than the other. Now, men are physically larger, so the police are going to look and say, okay, the man is the primary aggressor because he's physically larger. So you end up with a situation where it's the men that are being arrested.
Yes, but men are more psychologically less prone to you know, be violent towards women. So it's not just a matter of size. It's a very blunt instrument. And what struck me was that the male commenters on these pieces on domestic violence, even though they were, you know, supportive of you know, the men's rights position, were clueless on what would actually happen if they drummed up the courage to avoid the shame and rang the police. I mean, they could very likely be arrested themselves, even though they're the victims. One in four apprehended violence orders in Queensland are now being made by men.
Against work female aggressors.
Yes, that's right. And even though statistically we sort of understand that it's more 50-50, so do these men writing into the papers. Their perception is that men don't make these AVOs because they're fearful of being ridiculed.
Robert, should we go back to the primary aggressor thing? Can you fill me in a bit more on that?
So the primary aggressor is a concept that I believe started with the Duluth model. It essentially accepts tacitly that both partners in a relationship may be violent, which, as we know, is the case in about 50% of all intimate partner violence. But the Duluth model works around this little problem by assigning one person the primary aggressor role, and that's the person the police will arrest. Now, men are physically larger, and men also tend to be more openly aggressive. So when the police turn up and they are taught to assess and look for the primary aggressor, who do they find? Well, they find the man and they arrest the man. And that's the case, even though both of the partners will have been violent towards each other.
There was one case I heard where a man was stabbed by his wife. He had a knife in his back, and both an ambulance and the police turned up, and the police wanted to arrest him and take him away. But the ambulance guy said, "Sorry, mate, he's ours."
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
We know of other cases where men have been stabbed in the back and the woman hasn't been, even here in Australia, the man has been stabbed in the back and the woman hasn't subsequently been charged.
The problem is that men don't seem to understand, you know, the actual gender politics, the actual laws and rules and protocols on the ground and how they operate.
Right.
And it's not surprising because they're not really debated in parliaments. They're sort of just brought in late at night, you know, when often attached to some other bill. They're brought in on the down low, on the quiet. They don't want public discussion about it. The first thing many men find out about just how unfair and gendered, you know, the law is when they first turn up in court or see their solicitor.
And that's not just the to do with domestic violence and intimate partner violence either. The entire criminal justice system is biased against men. It's absolutely been proven all around the world. Every stage, from initial investigation through to sentencing, there's a bias against men.
In that case, where do men go to get support and knowledge if they suddenly find themselves in court?
Well, there's very little to support men, unfortunately. I mean, various jurisdictions have women's legal agencies where women can get access to free legal services because of their gender. There is no such equivalent for men. We're looking at possibly providing some limited services.
MRB? Men's Rights
Brisbane? Well, Australian Men's Rights Association, more generally. Yeah.
Right.
Some limited services. We have to look at the liability and so forth. So there's a few things to look at. But it wouldn't be legal support, but it would be some people who have been trained in court procedures and so forth and can help the men along.
If you're in Brisbane, there is an outfit called Men's Wellbeing that meets once at the monthly at the Rosicrucian Hall. I believe they're more a support group. They're a non-for-profit, And I think they're also associated with a law firm which will do discounted rates for men in problems with gendered law.
I'd also like to mention the Australian Brotherhood of Fathers. So they're on the ground doing some good work. Leith Erickson can often be found standing outside courthouses in Brisbane. He's been known to go in with men, and I think some of his other people in ABF as well have been known to go in and sit beside men who are attending court and just be and provide some moral support.
They have a name, don't they, Rock?
They do. They're called a McKenzie friend. And it's actually it's a legal term from the UK where the concept was invented. It was actually a Queensland barrister who was in the UK on a sabbatical. I think by that they mean holiday. And an English gentleman had run out of money and couldn't afford a legal service anymore. And a lawyer in that firm asked this Queensland barrister if he could sit in not as a legal representative but rather as just an assistant, and it was permitted. And because the gentleman's name was McKenzie, it ended up being called a McKenzie friend, and we've now adopted that concept too. But the original McKenzie friend, I believe, is still working as a barrister in Queensland.
Now, all these links to groups that you could turn to for assistance if you find yourself in that situation, are they on Men's Rights Australia's website or MRB?
They will be on our new website, which is launching soon.
Well, very good. All right, we're coming up to the 15-minute mark in our third podcast, I think.
Fourth,
all right. And I know there's a couple of things that you both wanted to mention. One was
just a bit about Me Too, if we have a few minutes left.
Yes.
I was talking about the last time about the movie The Hunting Ground, and that's a film that explores the alleged sexual predation of women by male students on university campuses. And it was actually 19 Harvard law professors signed off on a protest form saying not only discrediting and bucking the statistics, but also mentioning that at least one of the victims presented turned out to be a false accusation. And the thing is, this film has been widely acclaimed. It's been debunked and discredited, you know, by quite some official sources like Harvard, and yet it circulates with the highly acclaimed tag.
It's used as evidence, isn't it?
It is. And it was even selected to be one of six documentaries in the 2015 philanthropic Good Pitch Australia conference at the Sydney Opera House. So this is where many of, you know, the thought originators, the academics, policymakers attend these things, and you know they take them very seriously.
Well, it's amazing they get away with it, still rolling this film out.
And they do, and really the media are ideologically driven. They don't even hide it anymore. There's this very, very serious bias there. The academia, the social sciences are in a terrible state. There's actually an article that was just been written by a very, very experienced anthropologist, and we got permission to put it on A Voice for Men, so that article's there, and that talks about the problems in anthropology, how it's been driven by so much ideology today.
What does that actually mean, Robert, for dummies like me? What do you mean, problems with anthropology?
Well, certainly. So the feminist narrative is essentially the people who are supposedly in there doing actual research are actually pushing an ideological position. So through sociology, so when they talk about ancient societies, for example, they'll be talking all about violence against women in the society, for example, when in reality, like our society, there's actually a lot more violence against men, for example. But they're pushing that ideological position and portraying it as research. And here we have a very experienced, I think he's got about 40 years of experience in anthropology. He's come out, written an article. I saw it last week online, contacted him, and he's graciously gave us permission to put it on A Voice for Men.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time. Was there anything, any last things you wanted to bring up, Robert or Russell?
Yeah, there is something that we'd actually both like to bring up, and it's a bit upbeat. I'm actually pretty happy about this. So this is all anonymous. We have in the men's rights movement, we have quite an active community around the world in Australia. We, as well as getting into doing activism and so forth, a lot of us are friends. We have our private groups we talk in. An MRA told us a story in a private group, and he gave us permission. It was so good, he gave us permission to actually talk about it anonymously, and we'll also be putting something up on A Voice for Men as well. So this MRA is a teaching student in Australia. They were talking to a class. It was a class of boys, and they were talking about themselves. You'll notice that I'm not even talking about the gender of the person involved. They were talking about themselves, explaining a little bit about themselves, and then they said, "Would any questions?" And one of the boys stood up in the class and said,
"Sir, what do you think about feminism?"
So the quote was, "What do you think about feminism?"
And he thought for a few moments, you know, on what might be, you know, an appropriate answer, and then came out with, "I think feminism is cancer."
And the boys stood up and cheered. And that's what, now this was a grade 8 class. We're seeing 12, 13-year-old boys standing up and cheering. So far, there hasn't been any backlash over this, but the person involved wants to keep it anonymous. But I think it shows what's happening with the young boys. They know what's going on. And as the person pointed out, these boys will be voting in 5 or 6 years.
Yes. Well, I must say I'm surprised. I can't believe with the level of indoctrination there is that they would react like that.
That's right. That's probably the most encouraging thing. There's no doubt that these boys have been indoctrinated into feminist propaganda, and they haven't swallowed it.
That's a good story to leave on. We'll see if we're back in 2 weeks' time, because this secret location that we're in, it can only last so long before we're rumbled.
Before it's no longer a secret.
That's right. Well, gentlemen,
thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Hopefully you'll hear us again in another 2 weeks with Christy.
Yes, that's right. Thank you.